This is Dr. Jeffrey Hudon in his teaching on biblical archaeology. This is session number 7, The Geographical Arena, Part 3.
Okay, our next region to study, as we look at the geographical context of understanding the archaeology of the Bible, is the Shvelah, and that's a Hebrew word meaning, again, lowland, but it's actually foothills and valleys, and you can see some pictures of it here and here. And again, that's taken from the perspective of the Israelites up in the hill country, looking to the west and seeing that lowland or foothills below them, and that's where the term Shvelah comes from. The Shvelah is a series of valleys that come out of the hill country and go, what kind of meander their way out to the coast. And they are in sequence the Ayalon Valley, and again, this is where the sun stood still in Joshua, chapter, book of Joshua during the conquest. The major city along the Ayalon Valley is Gezer. And then farther south is the Sorek Valley, and that comes actually in, or begins up near Jerusalem, the Rephaim Valley. And the Sorek Valley, again, means red, probably from the viticulture that took place along it. And the major city there, kind of the gateway city, is Beit Shemesh. And farther down would be Timnah. And then farther south from the Sorek Valley is the Elah Valley, famous, of course, for the battle between David and Goliath. But the major city there, gateway city, is Azekah or Azekah, both an Israelite city and a Canaanite city. And then farther south is the Lachish Valley, and of course that is dominated by the site of Lachish, the major city of Lachish. And again, these pictures kind of give an idea of the terrain there. You've got valleys and foothills, low hills, excellent for farming. But remember, geopolitically, you've got the Philistines here and the Israelites up here. We're talking about an Iron Age pre-monarchy and early monarchy context here. And so the Shvelah served as the border area. This is where the wars, most of the wars and battles took place. If the Israelites are strong, they would push the Philistines back into the coastal plain. If the Philistines were strong, they would push the Israelites back up to the hill country and even farther. So that gives us an idea of the importance of the Shvelah. Here's the Ayalon Valley. You can see the modern freeway here in the distance. But again, very, very famous, both in antiquity and in modern times, for wars and battles being fought at in this valley. Beautiful valley. And here is the major city dominating the Ayalon Valley, which is Gezer. And Gezer was both a powerful Canaanite city and later an Israelite city, a city that Solomon fortified. In the book of 1 Kings, it mentions that. And this is the famous Solomonic Gate at Gezer. You can see the city drain going here. This would have been paved over. This is the inner gateway into the city and the six chambers here, and this famous six-chamber gate, again, shown here. Another famous monument at Gezer is the Canaanite High Place, a series of massive vot, standing stones, that was some sort of a worship area for Canaanites in the Bronze Age. Now, these in antiquity may have been plastered over with inscriptions on them or drawings. And of course, that's all has been long erased. But they still stand and actually were recently published by Bill Deaver in a paper. Okay, the next one south is the Sorek Valley. And this is famous for the stories in the book of Judges surrounding Samson. And Samson, this is kind of his bailiwick during his life. And you can see some of the scenes there from that valley. Beit Shemesh, the major city here. Interesting, again, Canaanite, then Israelite city. And you remember the Ark narrative, where the Ark was captured by the Philistines at the Battle of Ebenezer near Ephek, and then it made a circuit around the Philistine cities and caused all sorts of problems, and the Philistines sent it back on a cart up the Sorek Valley, and the men of Beit Shemesh were farming and saw that cart coming, and they sacrificed the oxen and were rejoicing that the Ark of the Lord was back in Israelite hands. Beit Shemesh has been excavated several times, most recently by Tel Aviv University, and lots of evidence there of occupation during the Iron Age, especially, and during the 8th century, ironically, we'll talk about this later, was unfortified. They were not able to find a city wall, which may have some interesting geopolitical connotations there. Zora, the hometown of Samson, again on this hilltop here, today wooded and covered by the reforestation of the Holy Land that's been going on both sides of the Jordan Valley. Elah Valley here is where, again, David fought Goliath. And we've got an interesting overview here of where things happened. Elah Valley itself here, this is to the east, this is to the west. And the famous site now of Kirbet Kiafa, which might be biblical Sha'arim, again, the dual form of Sha'ar, or gate, because there was two gates found there. Was this a stronghold of Saul, or was it a stronghold of David? There's questions about that. Did David build a post here or a city here, or was it built earlier by Saul? But the Israelites are in this area, camped in this area, and then the Philistine camp was across the valley, and David and Goliath fought in this area right here. So that gives a good bird's eye view of the arena of this mano-a-mano, man-on-man contest. Interestingly enough, Azekah is here. Again, later on, an important city of Judah. Gath of the Philistines, Goliath's hometown, is way out here in the coastal plain, still on the Elah Valley, along the Elah Valley here. Earlier ideas about Sha'arim, because the Philistines fled by way of the road to Sha'arim. And one suggestion was that there was two ways around Azekah, two gateways into the coastal plain. And that was a good explanation. But now we've got this city here with two gates, and that might be the name behind that, or the site behind that name. And then farther down we have Tel Asafi, which we've seen slides of before. Gan Leumi, Tel Safit, International Garden or Park. Tel Safit is the Hebrew name for Tel Asafi or Gath of the Philistines. And you've got these cutouts of Philistine soldiers here greeting the visitors to the site. And that is a major city. And again, during the 9th century, it was the largest city that we know of in the Levant. Much larger than Jerusalem or any other city. Very large. The archaeologists that have been working at Gath found an ostracon that's been incised with a variation of the name Goliath, which is kind of interesting there. Farther south along the Lachish Valley, we have the site of Lachish. Again, a major city, very large city, the second largest city in Judah, second only to Jerusalem. By the way, this is not an ancient wall. This is a wall built during the 1930s or later for dumping debris from the excavations here that was dumped here. But a very major city. Here's, again, an artist's rendition of what it looked like at the time of the Assyrian invasion in 701. And you can see this Judean palace fort here on the Acropolis, and the platform is still extant today. You can see the walls there. And it's been excavated several times. Currently, it's being excavated, I think, by an Austrian group. It was excavated by an American-Israeli expedition several years ago, and before that, of course, the major excavations by Yushishkin, and then before that, back in the 1930s, by James Leslie Starkey. It's an artist's rendition of the gates of Lachish being attacked by Sennacherib's troops in 701 B.C., Okay, Makeda, if you remember the defeat of the Canaanite coalition by the Israelites and Joshua, all the Canaanite kings hid in a cave, Makeda, and were killed there, and the entrance was sealed. And Makeda is probably a site called Kirbet El-Kom, located here, excavated in the 1970s by Deaver and by Jack Holliday at the University of Toronto, has not been published. They found inscriptions there, which have been published, the Kirbet El-Kom inscriptions, but the site has not been published. And unfortunately, Professor Holliday passed away. So that, I don't know who's working on that, but again, this is a problem in archaeology. You have an excavation and the excavator passes away. Who will take that task up and publish it? And obviously, information is lost when the professor dies, when the excavator dies. So the report's never going to be quite as good unless they kept fantastic notes, because your information that's in the head of that excavator is lost forever. Inscriptions here mention Yahweh and his Asherah, and of course Bill Deaver, who worked on those and published those in Hebrew Union College Annual, HUCA, back in the late 1960s, has made much of that, suggesting that there was some sort of a suppressed religion of God, Yahweh, the Lord, having a wife or consort. And what Deaver doesn't seem to understand is that the Bible talks about this. It's called syncretism, the blending of Canaanite and Israelite religions that was plagued Israel and Judah throughout its entire existence. So finding something like this should be of no surprise. It's simply Judeans and Israelites practicing syncretism, blending these two religions together. And this is not some suppressed, widespread folk religion that Deaver thinks it was. It was just simply practiced by many people because they took aspects of both religions and blended them together. So the tantalizing title there, the shocking title, shouldn't be a shock at all. One of the first sites that was systematically excavated in the Holy Land was a place called Tel Beit Mirsim. We still don't know the ancient name of the site. Albright thought it was Debir. He was wrong, unfortunately. But it was excavated in the 20s and 30s by William Foxwell Albright and published and well done for its time. This is quite an interesting picture here. This is Cyrus Gordon back in the early 1930s looking at what they thought was a dye vat. It's actually an olive press, bottom part of an olive press. Cyrus Gordon, I was privileged to hear him lecture back in 1992, before he passed away. But he was a brilliant Jewish scholar, just gifted in linguistic skills, and kind of a maverick. A lot of his ideas were kind of off the norm. But very, very influential scholar of his time. Okay, so we move from the Shvela up into the hill country, and you can see the difference again, similar to the hill country of Ephraim and Manasseh. This is the hill country of Judah, and the same similar terrain here. Bethel and Ai, we'll talk about that. Unpack that in another lecture, but again, views of this hill country terrain and some famous biblical sites. Again, you can see the suburbs of Jerusalem on the skyline here, but this is Gib, the site of ancient Gibeon. You can see again the terracing up, and the ancient city would have been at top here, partially covered now by a Palestinian town. Nearby Gib, or ancient Gibeon, is Nabi Samuel. And this is, in Arabic, that means the prophet Samuel, supposedly where he was buried, although the Bible says he wasn't buried there, he's buried in Ramah. And this is, again, an important site. It was a site on the horizon of Jerusalem, and excavations there have uncovered evidence from both New Testament and Old Testament, probably a watchtower or a fort that guarded the approaches to Jerusalem. Later on, both Muslim and Crusader armies would stop at Nabi Samuel and catch their first glimpse of the Holy City before advancing. Nabi Samuel was also probably the site of the high place of Gibeon. Not Gibeon itself, but the high place separate from the city. And you can see here from the Mount of Olives, way on the horizon, is the Muslim mosque atop Nabi Samuel as it appears today. By the way, that's where Solomon prayed for wisdom at the beginning of his reign. Very early shot here of modern shot of the ruins of Tel El Ful, or Gibeah of Saul, Givat Shaul in Hebrew. Tel El Ful simply means hill of beans, which is kind of funny, but it's probably the site of ancient Gibeah. Jerusalem again is to the south here. This is the main road up towards that goes north towards Shechem, and this is a corner of the ruins. First excavated by Albright in the 1920s, then by Paul Lapp in the 1960s, and some work done later than that as well. Albright's work was not up to par. Lapp's was better. Again, can't be absolutely certain this is actually the site of Gibeah of Saul, but probably the best candidate. Again, another interesting modern footnote. You've got this partially finished building here. This is a picture from that building looking towards Jerusalem. Was the planned summer palace of King Hussein of Jordan. And that was under construction when the Six-Day War broke out in 1967. And there it sits, still unfinished, out of the reach of Jordanian king, and still is. But beautiful site, because from Gibeah, or from Tel El Ful, you can see both the Mediterranean and the Jordan Valley. You've got a wonderful vista there. And that would have been ideal place for a palace, whether you're King Saul or King Hussein. Just south of Jerusalem, is the start of the Rephaim Valley. And it actually, the start of the valley is actually the southern approaches to Jerusalem. And this is used since the Ottomans or the British built a railway from Jaffa up to Jerusalem. I believe the Ottomans did that. And that railway is still in existence. And that's the Rephaim Valley also was the green line between the West Bank and Israel proper. And so this was a border area during the years between the 1948-1967 wars. This was the breadbasket of Jerusalem. Again, farmsteads and farms and hamlets and villages dotted the Rephaim Valley and brought grew food, both on the slopes and in the valley itself, and provided Jerusalem and its environs with foodstuffs. At the very top of the Rephaim Valley, before it curves into its beginnings near Jerusalem, is a hilltop site of Ramat Rachel. It's today a modern resort and a kibbutz, and this is the pool there. And but on the hilltop is a Iron Age site. Now this Iron Age site was discovered and first excavated in the 1920s by Benjamin Mazar, and then later by Yohanan Aharoni, a Mazar student in the 1950s and early 60s. And later on, in 2007, I believe, Tel Aviv University did some extensive excavations and reinterpretation of the site. This is their interpretation of the palace and fort there or Mount Rachel, dated to the 8th and 7th century and then into the 6th century BC. This is probably a site that was established at least as early as the reign of Uzziah, and used by Hezekiah as well. And then the second phase was built by Jehoiakim, and that's mentioned in Jeremiah as Jeremiah complains and lashes out at Jehoiakim for spending money on fancy palaces, and he describes things that have been found in the excavations. There was Babylonian and Persian evidence of occupation here as well, including a lavish garden and terrace gardens around it. And again, the Tel Aviv people, led by Oded Lipschitz, have reinterpreted this as a more of an Assyrian, Babylonian site than a Judean site, which the material culture does not seem to fit at all. So I think they're wrong in their interpretation. I think it was a Judean site, and then again reused during the Persian period as an administrative site. Beautiful site, clearly a site that you'd want to have a palace at, beautiful views, and again the breeze coming from the Mediterranean up the Rephaim Valley hits the western slopes of this hillside. Farther south along the ridge route, south of Jerusalem, is Bethlehem of Judea. And again, most of its history, a very small village. Today, a large Palestinian city because of its connection with the birth of Christ there at the Church of the Nativity, or underneath the Church of the Nativity. Very little is known about Iron Age Jerusalem regarding the Old Testament as well as New Testament, because it's built over. And there has been places where limited excavations have taken place, and Iron Age materials have been found there. You remember David yearned for the water from the well at the gate of Jerusalem, and no spring has been found there. There could have been wells dug there, but no spring. And so these are all questions that remain unanswered. There was about 20 years ago an excellent article on the topography of Bethlehem, and came out, in PEQ, and Palestine Exploration Quarterly. Other than that, very little is known about Bethlehem during this earlier period. The name Bethlehem, of course, in Hebrew means house of bread. And it seems to be pre-Israelite, so there could have been some sort of a Canaanite shrine here, maybe to a grain god or something like that. These are all guesses. Beautiful view here. I've got an even more dramatic view of Bethlehem here in the hill country, the wilderness of Judah here, and then beyond the rift, you jump over the rift and you see the hill country of Jordan, the Madaba Plains, or the biblical Mishor. And there is that more dramatic view here. Again, you're here with the hill country, edge of the hill country here, with this believed Palestinian village. And then you drop down into the wilderness of Judah here, which is shown by these hills here. And then down to the Dead Sea. So you're maybe 2,000, 2,500 feet high here. The Dead Sea's 1,400 feet below sea level. Then you have the escarpment up to what could be the plains of Moab, the southern extension of the plains of Moab, where the Israelites camped, the Book of Numbers. And then finally the top summit of the Transjordanian Highlands, and that's the beginning of the Mishor, the Madaba Plains. So very dramatic view showing the different topographical, geographical regions in that part of the land. Farther south, we come to Hebron, Mount Hebron here. And again, it's a city, and archaeologically not very well known. There's been quite a bit of work, but a lot of the ancient tell of Hebron is covered by an Islamic shrine and unable to excavate that. This is the famous Cave of Machpelah, the burial place of the patriarchs, and we'll talk more about that in another slideshow. Some other vistas of the hill country of Judah. And then we go south into the Negev. Negev means dry or southland, and this is the southern part of the Holy Land, or the land of Israel. And it is kind of a transition zone. The biblical Negev is basically centered around Beersheba, and there's a eastern Negev and eastern Negev over here and a western Negev on this side of the ancient city of Beersheba. And this is a transition zone again that could be farmed on wet years. Dry farming was possible, but in dry years, no. It was just not possible to do agriculture. But it was an important area strategically, militarily, because it guarded it across the Negev, traversed the spice routes to the ports of Gaza and Ashkelon. And so if you controlled the Negev, especially the remote HaNegev or the southern Negev, we'll talk about in a minute, you had control over those trade routes, the spice routes. And that's one of the ways Solomon could bring so much income into the kingdom, because he extracted tolls from those caravans. Here's some pictures of the Negev and what it looks like. One of the major sites in the eastern Negev, biblical Negev, is Arad. We talked about Arad earlier. There's actually two cities here. The city, the early bronze city, which you see in the foreground here, which is a large city, very well preserved, excavated by Ruth Amiron. And then the Israelite citadel, one of the border forts of Judah, that was excavated by Aharoni, both in the 1960s. And there's some other pictures. You can see the wall line of the early bronze city with horseshoe-shaped towers, very characteristic of that early period. And then, of course, the Israelite gateway into the reconstructed into the citadel. Beersheba, again, is the center, the kind of the queen of the Negev. And we've seen pictures of that before, or a photo of that, describing what a tell looks like, but you can see some of the reconstruction work that has gone on. This was a planned city. It wasn't just built haphazardly. It was planned and built very carefully during the Iron Age by the Kingdom of Judah. South of the Negev is the Negev Highlands. And again, these are biblical terms. When you say Negev in modern Hebrew, it's all the southern, long southern part of the state of Israel, all the way down to Eilat. So this is again, biblical terminology. The Negev Highlands are very inhospitable. However, very dry and rugged. Moktesh Rimon is a large crater. There's Moktashim is kind of a unique Israeli term for these geological or geographical depressions or craters that dot this area. Avdat is a city built by the Nabataeans, a New Testament era city in the Negev Highlands, by the Nabataeans who built Petra and some of the other great cities in Jordan and northern Saudi Arabia. Wilderness of Zin, this is where the Israelites, again, in the modern Negev, Negev Highlands, this is where the Israelites sojourned in the wilderness. Another picture of the wilderness is in here. Now, even in this very inhospitable area, in the 11th or 10th century, there was a series of paramilitary forts built on hilltops in various areas of this expanse. And they were in different shapes. They were circular, or they just followed the topography of the hilltop. But the question has been asked numerous times: who built these? Were they Israelites? Were they Israelite attempts to settle this area, perhaps under David or Solomon, or were they non-Israelite sites by Bedou people such as the Amalekites or other peoples? And this is still kind of an open question. There's been a lot of articles written on that. One of these sites is unique in a way that it's slightly later, late 9th, early 8th century, Horvat Timan, or more properly known as Kuntelet Ashrud. And we'll talk more about that when we talk about our 8th century sites. But very interesting site for sure. Kadesh Barnea is another site in the Negev Highlands. Again, technically in Sinai today, both Kuntelet Ashrud and Kadesh Barnea are currently in Egypt. but both excavated by Israelis during the occupation of Sinai. You can see the towers, the fort here, the towers around the square fortress. Kadesh Barnea, again, was where the Israelites encamped because there was a spring there, and the spring Ein Kedesh preserves that name, Kadesh, or holy, derivative of the term holy. Okay, east of the Negev is the Arava, and this is an extension of the Rift Valley south of the Dead Sea, all the way to the Gulf of Elad or the Gulf of Aqaba, whatever you want to call it. And this is a kind of a depression. It goes to slightly above sea level and then back down to sea level as it hits the Gulf of Elad. And Israelis have, as you can see here, have made use of this and built communities there, including Yotvata, a kibbutz, and famous for its chocolate milk. That says chocolate there, shokol, chocolate milk from the Yotvata oasis in the Arava. In the last 15, 20 years, there's been extensive excavations actually on the Jordanian side of the Arava. Arava is today a political border, runs in the middle of that between Israel and Jordan. On the Jordanian side, the Wadi Fainan has sites there have uncovered a huge copper mining operation. And this is the main site of Kerbet and Nahas, the ruins of copper, I guess you could say. And that's been excavated by UCSD, University of California, San Diego, and Tom Levy. And some very dramatic finds there, as well as farther south at Timna, the Timna Valley, by Tel Aviv University, has found, again, through radiocarbon dating, they've been pretty clear that this is 10th century activity here, mining activity, major mining activity. This is clearly not just a local organized operation. This is clearly from a large kingdom, a polity that would do this. And the question is who? We believe this is clearly the work of Solomon. And this is a gateway into their complex here. And they've actually found, dung from donkeys still preserved in this gateway of donkeys being corralled there or held there as their owners unpack and pack. So amazing finds, amazing discoveries there. Anyway, we'll talk more about that. Elat and Etzion Geber, this is the port, this is the end of the Arava, and this is the Gulf of Aqaba or Elat. Elat's in the foreground here, the Jordanian city of Aqaba is over here, the border between the two nations is in the center. And somewhere in this area was the Solomon's port of Etzion Geber. Where was that? That's another debate as well. In the late 1930s, Nelson Gluick, our famous rabbi archaeologist we talked about earlier, excavated a site called Tel El Khalife, right in the middle of the Arava. This is the Arava here looking north or looking south. I'm not sure which. But this is the Arava here, north-south axis, and uncovered what he believed was biblical Etzion Geber, a Solomonic seaport, and copper mining complex. And the copper mining complex with furnaces and whatnot fell by the wayside. He backed off of that interpretation. But he still believed this was the Solomonic port of Etzion Geber. The problem was this was restudied and published by Gary Practico in the 1980s, early 90s, and Practico recognized that the pottery looks like it only went back to about the 8th century, not the 10th century, the time of Solomon. So if it's Etzion Geber, we have a chronological issue here. Farther south, however, past the border between Israel and Egypt, is a place called Coral Island. And this is a picture of it here. We've got some other pictures, I think, coming up. And this was an island that had a sheltered lagoon and may be our answer to the site of Etzion Geber, or the Solomonic seaport. There's a better picture of it there, looking over to Jordan and then Saudi Arabia to the south across the Gulf of Aqaba. A site that's been surveyed and looked at. This is a medieval fort, castle up here, but it had casemate walls around it, and Iron Age pottery was found. Was this the site of Etzion Geber? Possibly. Again, those questions remain open. So if that was Etzion Geber, what was Tel El Khalifeh that Gluck excavated? Possibly biblical Eilat or some other site that was occupied either by Edom or Israel, Judah, or both. Okay, so we cross over the rift and go into Transjordan here, and we look at the Edomite highlands. This is the place where Esau and his descendants lived, became the kingdom of Edom. And this is, again, Nubian sandstone, reddish hue to this stone, stones, again, where you get the term Edom from Adam. And very high in elevation. Again, these hilltops got up to 3,500 feet above sea level. And with that elevation, you got adequate rainfall and you could do dry farming. But for the most part, unless you're in the highlands, Edom was very dry and barren. Here's a picture from Petra Park overlooking some of the mountains around that great site. Again, biblical Edom. Now, very, very famous landmark or famous site in Edom is Mount Hor. And Mount Hor is where Aaron was buried by Moses and the people of Israel as they passed through. And this is accessible via a long hike from Petra. And the views are, as you can see here, spectacular. The actual shrine is a Muslim shrine. It was rebuilt Byzantine shrine below that. Actually, Finnish excavations nearby are uncovering kind of a complex of buildings lower down the mountain that's perhaps a support network for this pilgrimage shrine. Not sure about that, but an incredible view from Mount Hor, or today called Jebel Harun in Arabic. And this is a view again from Edom out to the Arava and the wilderness of Zin beyond. So again, a beautiful spectacle of biblical history, because you see the Arava, and then in the haze, not real clear here, is the wilderness of Zin, where the Israelites sojourned for 40 years. And then finally, another good picture of Transjordan from the perspective of the hill country. Again, hill country, wilderness of Judah, the Midbar, the Dead Sea, and then the Jordanian highlands. So a lot of different regions and sub-regions in the Holy Land, and a lot of different climatic conditions, some very rich, some very dry, but a very, very large variety of topography and regional differences. Thank you very much.
This is Dr. Jeffrey Hudon in his teaching on biblical archaeology. This is session number 7, The Geographical Arena, Part 3.